you also have, from the Irish Catholic period, you have a clerical tincture to this as well. Some of the best of these historians are, like Murphy, Dennis Murphy, his Cromwell in Ireland, it's a fine history. Patrick Moran's persecution of Irish Catholics and penal laws. These are more, he's more polemical or more strident. You have Prendergast, he was a barrister, J.P. Prendergast, his landmark Cromwellian settlement in Ireland, 1893. Thomas Fitzpatrick's Bloody Bridge, a refutation of the, probably the best of the refutations of the massacre myth of 1640, 1641 rather. And on the other side you have Mary Hickson's Ireland in the 17th century, which, notwithstanding the title, is actually about, it reproduces many of the, a lot of depositions, to some extent culls them to get the, but doesn't, if you like, falsify, but culls them to get the to make the case, I suppose, of an irredeemable collective guilt on the part of the Irish for this massacre. So a lot of stuff, a lot of writing coming out in the 19th century, but not as intense an engagement, I think, as in the 18th century.
That brings us to the 20th century. Now, obviously, in the 20th century, we have another great break in Irish history, which might in some ways be comparable with the 17th century, and that is that British rule ends in most of Ireland, and a whole new understanding of history comes about. So how did this affect people's understanding of the 16th and 17th centuries?
Well, in the context of the Northern Troubles, there was, I suppose, an understandable public-minded idea of trying to focus on a useful history, a history that doesn't inflame people, that doesn't focus over much on the bad stuff, the atrocities, the perpetrated by one community and the other, and that's understandable. However, the problem with that, if you start distort, as long as you, that's fine, as long as you don't distort the truth, as long as you don't tell lies. But when you elide or evade what happened, then you're in danger of not telling the truth. That's problematic. Or you're in danger, at the very least, of coming up with a very bland history. So the famous critique of this process is Brendan Bradshaw's Nationalism and Historical Scholarship. Now, I wouldn't go along with everything he says, but he makes some very powerful points. For him, the process, the term, of course, a revisionist, is something that every historian worth his or her salt would say, I am a revisionist. You wouldn't pick up a pen or hit the keyboard to write in the first place if you didn't have something to revise, something to say that was different from what had been said before. But in the Irish context, revisionism has a different meaning. For its proponents, it's revising a mytho history of Irish nationalism, whereby taking apart the idea that you have this immemorial Irish nation in perpetual struggle with its English oppressors over a period of centuries, the struggle essentially remains the same, and you're trying to deconstruct that, and you're trying to say, look, hang on, maybe this idea of a collective nationhood or collective identity was relatively late, they would say, maybe as late as the 19th century. They would tend to focus on divisions within, if you like, the Irish Catholic or nationalist community, by way of illustrating this lack of cohesiveness over time. And they would be more comfortable with, I suppose, the exceptional individuals and the survivors and the people who made some sort of terms with, rather than those who were advocating a collective resistance. For Bradshaw, this wasn't, on his own terms, value-free history, because it focuses a very sceptical and destructive, what he called an invincible scepticism against Irish nationalism and its story. It argues that there is no grand narrative, there is no big story. Mm-hmm. Thus, in the proclamation of 1916, what is it, six times in the past 200 years Irishmen have struck, that kind of argument for an Irish nationalist grand narrative for revisionists is unsustainable. And where do you end up eventually? Well, you end up with two things. A, you can end up with a history, and this is a point made by Dave Edwards particularly, which elides the catastrophic dimension of Irish history. This is, Bradshaw makes the point that deliberately or catastrophe is elided, the story of the victims, the dispossessed, ignored. And Bradshaw gives the example of Moody's classic study of the Londonderry plantation, 1935. It's an administrative study of governmental or administrative process which doesn't engage with what do the people who are at the receiving end of this think about this. It's written from within the perspective of the people carrying out the plantation. So that's the burden, as it were, of Bradshaw's critique, which all these years on, I mean, holds true. The question isn't as urgent, perhaps, now that the troubles are over, but we've moved into the question of history, and reading history will always be a live one. I mean, even today now, if you look at the way in which history can be distorted, I would give as an example, and I'm moving a little bit from my brief, John, as a nearly modernist, out of my comfort zone. I was surprised by the way in which the Minister for Defence, Alan Shatter, Minister for Defence and Justice, handled the question of pardoning deserters from the Irish Army during the Second World War or the emergency or what you will. Because his argument for doing that was not on a humanitarian basis, which I think a lot of people, personally I wouldn't, but a lot of people would say, yes, a long time ago, they're all men, forgive and forget, and so on. No, the point Minister Shatter was making is that these men preferred the better moral choice. The vast majority of people who served their country, who maintained their oath, who defended their country during the Second World War against the threat of invasion from either side, they made the less moral choice, the morally poor choice. He said that. And therefore, what are you doing there? You have the extraordinary situation where a minister is subjecting the past of his own state, of his own department, of his own army, to a very destructive criticism. He's saying that, which is presentist, which is taking a present-centred view. In other words, it's assuming, A, that the Allied powers fought against the Holocaust. They didn't. Every single power that was involved in the Second World War, barring England and France, and Germany, of course, were involved because they were attacked. And because they were attacked, nobody willingly got involved in that war. They did not set out on a crusade against Nazism. Most countries who had a choice, tried to keep neutral. Some smaller countries managed it, others did not. But to actually criticise the people who kept their oaths, who obeyed, who defended their country, in the light of a present-centred history which doesn't take any account of the realities of that time. It doesn't take account of the fact that the people who might have deserted might have been doing so for ideological motives, that they might the following year have been back with an invasion fleet or columns, which could have happened had there been a British invasion. There are all of these aspects to it. This is where history, the battle for history, is important. Or you can end up with something in the effort to make something that is mutually acceptable to both communities or all communities, you can end up with something that is terribly, terribly bland. You can have the National Day of Commemoration, for example, celebrates, as far as I can see, all Irishmen who died anywhere, anytime, for any cause whatsoever. It is a staggeringly vacuous and unengaging history. It presupposes that the very act of fighting and dying in a war, or serving in a war, or serving in an army, somehow elevates the person to be worthy of commemoration, not what they fight for. Thus, we're equally invited to celebrate the Connacht Ranger who put down the sepoys in the Indian Mutiny, or the Irish nationalists who fought on the side of the Boers in the Boer War, whatever. Everything is there. It's all there. And at the end of the day, when it's all so all-encompassing, all-inclusive, it's disengaging. It just doesn't. It's bland. It's it's not part of any story. So the end result of this revisionist project is that you end up with, instead of a story, a grand narrative or a story which makes sense, which may you need to interrogate to make sure it's not distorting, excluding, whatever, you end up with history as a random assemblage of stuff that happened.
Mm-hmm. Just to wrap up then, I mean, the rejoinder of that is that the revisionists, I guess, if you want to use that word, rejoinder, is that the criticism of the revisionist project is based on the idea that no criticism of Irish nationalism is allowed at all.
You allow that. For example, you could take the view that, and I often wonder, can you actually speak of an Irish history of Ireland before the 16th or 17th century? You could take the view as a proper subject of study. I mean, was there a unitary place? You know, legal scholars, linguistic scholars, and others would dispute that. You can take the view that nationalism, as we understand it, an effective mobilising collective identity, might be quite much later. Was it a 19th, 18th, 17th century phenomenon, 16th century? You can differ about these. Are huge issues that you can differ within. You can accept that an awful lot of, you know, the heroes have feet of clay, that the not everything should be seen in terms of dichotomy, British-Irish or English-Irish, that there are episodes of coexistence, consensus, as well as outbreaks of conflict. It's just that you don't ignore the role of conflict as well. So I think what you're trying to do is be more balanced. So the greatest criticism, the most effective criticism the revisionists would have had of Bradshaw was the use of his phrase, engaging with the past with a degree of empathy or feeling for the past, and engagement with it and an emotional identification with it. And they would say, no, you don't. You're a scientist, you're trying to be value-free, you're studying this as a social phenomenon, and the view of the historian's role is he or she scientist or is history and art. That's over to you.
Okay, Padraig Lenihan, thank you very much.
Okay,